Well, thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Clements against Fashing. Okay. Give him 2 minutes to catch up. Mr. Allison, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case involves Article 16, Section 65 of the Texas Constitution, the resign to run provision, and Article 3, Section 19, concerning eligibility to the state legislature. The action was brought for declaratory judgment and injunctive relief, alleging violation of the 1st, 5th, and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. The office holder plaintiffs were a judge of the county court at law, two justices of the peace, and a constable. Other plaintiffs included citizens and registered voters. The defendants were the local and state officers who were charged with the enforcement of the challenge provisions. The district court held that both Article 16, Section 65, and Article 3, Section 19 contravened the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and therefore the district court granted the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment and injunctive relief. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit affirmed the district court opinion, adopting the memorandum opinion of the district court. A short, very brief historical background on these provisions and the Texas political system would be helpful in analyzing these provisions. The current Texas Constitution was adopted in 1876. The Constitution provides for a very decentralized system of government. Under this Constitution, almost all local and state offices are elected. And from 1876 until the 1950s, each of these, almost all of these, were elected for a 2-year term. In the 1950s, 4-year terms were extended to most of these offices. In 1954, 4-year terms were extended to the precinct and county offices included in Article 16, Section 65. In 1958, after the people of the state had extended 4-year terms to these offices, the resign-to-run provision in Article 16, Section 65 was adopted. Article 3, Section 19 has been included in the Texas Constitution since the Constitution of the Republic of Texas, drafted in 1836. I would first like to point out an error in the conclusions reached by the district court in its memorandum opinion. The district court found and apparently relied heavily upon a distinction between the application of the resign-to-run rule to the Office of Justice of the Peace and its application to the Office of Municipal Court Judge. The district court stated that the Justice of the Peace is included under Article 16, Section 65, and the Municipal Court Judge, who has very similar jurisdiction, is not, and found that to be a distinction of some great importance in finding that the resign-to-run rule contravened the Constitution. What the district court overlooked was Article 11, Section 11 of the Texas Constitution, adopted in 1958 at the same time as the resign-to-run rule in Article 16, Section 65. Article 11, Section 11 states that any municipality which extends the terms of its officers from 2 years to 4 years, that once that is done, that those officers will be under the same resign-to-run provisions as offices that are under Section 16, Article 16, Section 65. So there is no distinction between the application of the resign-to-run rules between the Office of Justice of the Peace and any municipal office, whether
is
it be a municipal judge.
Was that called to the attention of the district judge?
No, Your Honor. To the best of my knowledge, it was not.
Even after the judgment?
I don't know. Your Honor, I did not have this case until after the Fifth Circuit had ruled on it.
But municipal judges who still have 2-year terms are still subject to the resign-to-run rule?
No, sir.
I mean, they aren't. They are not subject to it.
They are not.
No, that's right.
because no one with a two-year term is subject to resign the run rule. Only when they adopt a four-year term.
Was that necessarily destroy the distinction that does that necessarily destroy the holding below?
I think it destroys the contrast, because any time that a municipal judge is in the same position as a justice of the peace, that is holding a four-year term, that he's under exactly the same rule.
Well, it might depend on whether the difference is relevant.
It might.
Is there any question but what the State Trial Court of General Jurisdiction was, that this district court is subject to Article 3, Section 19?
Whether Article 3, Section 19 or Article 16, Section 65?
Article 3, Section 19.
No, it is subject to Article 3, Section 19. In analyzing these provisions, I think it important to note the activities or rights which are not restricted under these two provisions. There's no question that the right to vote is not included and is not restricted under either of these provisions. Neither is the right to support other candidates, the right to speak out on issues, or the right to test the water.
May I get back just a moment to what you tell us was the error of the district court? What can we do about that? Can we correct it?
I think you can correct it by reversing the judgment. I pointed out simply that the district court was in error in arriving at that conclusion and using it.
Yes, but you said this was relied on very heavily.
It appeared to be.
To support the finding of unconstitutionality.
Yes.
But it's a matter of Texas law, I guess, isn't it?
Well.
Ordinarily, we don't second guess holdings of district judges or courts of appeals
in this case,
to what state law is.
In this case, it appears to be a conclusion of law as to whether or not there is
a rule. I know, but we'd have to read the sections. You said you misconstrued. And we'd have to what? Do what? Construe it ourselves?
I think you would have to reach the conclusion that there is no difference between the application of resign to run rules between these two offices.
I wonder, what's the highest, the Texas court that would take care of a question like this? The Supreme Court, or is it the Texas Supreme Court?
If it were ever presented to it, yes.
Well, do you say that's an error of law or an error of fact by the district judge, by the trial judge?
I think it's both. I think the court was in error as to the fact of whether or not there was a resign to run rule applicable to the municipal court judges, and they then arrived at an erroneous conclusion of law that Article 16, Section 65 creates a difference in classification between the two offices.
The real error was in not giving the judge a chance to straighten it out. Right?
If I do not know. I don't know if the judge will straighten it out.
He wasn't given the opportunity. You didn't call it to his attention.
To my knowledge, it was not.
You didn't, but I mean your office was responsible for it.
The record does not reflect that it was called to his attention at that time.
And that it could have been straightened out then, couldn't it?
Right. It was pointed out at the Fifth Circuit.
Did I understand you to say the judge overlooked a recent statute?
No, sir. He overlooked Article 11, Section 11 of the Texas Constitution.
That was not newly enacted.
No, sir. It was adopted at the same time as Article 16, Section 65, resign to run provision. It was on the same ballot.
His opinion did not mention that at all?
No, sir.
And so what you're saying is he simply, so far as the face of his opinion goes, did not consider an article and section of the Texas Constitution?
Yes, sir.
So he didn't construe it, he just didn't, apparently didn't cite it at all,
right,
or consider it.
That's correct. I'd further point out that among the activities not restricted by Article 16, Section 65, is the right to test the water, that persons who contemplate running for office in Texas have the opportunity to go out and solicit possible support without having to resign in office. And that is in direct opposition to the position taken by the plaintiff appellees in this case. I'd further point out that the Texas resign to run rule does not involve any suspect classifications. There is no direct burden upon any particular portion of the electorate or upon any particular political viewpoint. The only effects upon the voters would be if they wish to support a particular candidate and that candidate was in midterm of an office he was holding at the time and he declined to run because of the resign to run rule. In that limited sense, you could say that the Article 16, Section 65, resign to run provisions, has some slight effect upon the pool of candidates available to the voters. Otherwise, it has none. Article 16, Section 65 appears to be a unique resign-to-run provision. Although a majority of the states now have some resign-to-run rule, Article 16, Section 65 differs, as nearly as I can determine, from all of these, in that Article 16, Section 65 applies only to the first 3 years of a four-year term. In the last year of your term in Texas, you're free to run for any office, either re-election to the office you then hold or for any other office that you might choose to announce for. I believe this is important in weighing the rationale behind the adoption of the resign-to-run rule. In 1954, when the four-year terms were extended, replacing the two-year terms, the people of Texas staggered the terms to be served. That is, they provided that approximately one-half of the office holders would come up every 2 years, thereby shortening the ballot. But what this also did was create a temptation and an opportunity for an office holder in midterm, in the middle of the four-year term that had been extended to him, to run for another office, to take a free ride while continuing to hold the office that he had been elected to for a four-year term. The state interests served by the resign-to-run rule have been widely discussed in other cases and were recognized by the district court in its opinion in this case. The resign-to-run rule prevents abuse of office, and in this case, by applying it to the first 3 years of the term, it also prevents neglect of the duties of the office, in that a person may not go out and use his time to run for office while occupying the office he's been elected to. It also prevents abuse of office by a losing candidate, who, if he were allowed to run in midterm, would return to the office that he had presently held and continue to serve for 2 years after having run and lost for another race. And certainly it also eliminates even the appearance of impropriety of candidates who are holding an office being allowed to run for higher office or other office in the middle of their term. There is no less restrictive means to achieve these ends. The other possibilities, a leave of absence provision, for example, would certainly not prevent the abuse of office by a losing candidate who returned to the office. The criminal statute, which prohibits abuse of office or abuse of official power, does not in any way affect the neglect of duties that could occur while an office holder left his office and went out and ran for another office in the middle of his term.
Do you see any comparison or analogy between the resign to run provision and the provision of Article 1, Section 6 of the United States Constitution that says no senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States which shall have been created or the emoluments thereof have been increased during such time?
Yes, and I certainly see an analogy between that and Article 3, Section 18 of the Texas Constitution, which has the same provision, and I've decided we'll reach further in my argument. And certainly see an analogy between that and the provisions of both the Federal Hatch Act and the State Hatch Act, which also prohibit candidacy. The plaintiffs in this case, and appellees here, argue that apparently the resign-to-run rule is defective because it's under-inclusive. They argue that it does not apply to everyone. It only applies to them. And it's true that there are a number of offices excepted from the rule. The process of arriving at a decision through the legislature is always one of compromise, and certainly that was involved in the arriving at this resign-to-run rule. But to hold the resign-to-run rule unconstitutional simply because it makes too many exceptions would require that a statute or constitutional provision either go all the way in treating a problem or not attack the problem at all.
You think the exemption of state legislators from the rule was a result of compromise?
Possibly, though I would certainly point out that members of the House of Representatives only serve a two-year term anyway. So the resigned rule purpose of preventing them from neglecting their duties in midterm while running for another office would have no application to them, because they have to run either for re-election or other office every 2 years. State Senate, that may have been the case.
Well, do we have to find that this is a result of a compromise, or that this is the deliberate choice of the state legislature for reasons which they haven't explained, or perhaps don't need to explain?
I think that the provisions can be upheld on the basis of any rational basis for their application. But if you go beyond that...
Do you have any system of preserving the legislative history, the evolution of a statute in Texas?
Unfortunately, at the time these provisions were adopted in 1954 and 1958, there was no legislative history as such in Texas.
These were amendments proposed by the legislature, were they?
Amendments proposed by the legislature, adopted by the people.
Yes.
I would point out that the exceptions found in Article 16, Section 65, are not classes of persons. They do not involve any suspect categories. They are exceptions of specific positions. And the presumption there is that the legislature based these exemptions upon some circumstances within their knowledge, and that the judiciary will not normally invade that province of the legislature. Article 3, Section 19 has been similarly attacked on the same basis that it creates classifications, and the same arguments apply. I would also point out that the standing of these plaintiffs to attack Article 3, Section 19 is particularly objected to by the appellants, in that there is no plaintiff who indicated a definite intention to run for the legislature. Article 3, Section 19 provides that any person holding a lucrative office in the state shall not be eligible for the legislature during the term for which they are elected. None of the plaintiffs in this case indicated that they definitely intended to come within that provision. One of the plaintiffs said that if it weren't for Article 16, Section 65, requiring him to resign the position he then held, he might run for the legislature or he might run for one or two other offices that he named in his affidavit. We do not believe that that meets the standing case and controversy requirement in order to challenge the constitutionality of Article 3, Section 19.
Again, each of these plaintiffs falls within one of the categories to whom Section 19 applies? I mean, he's either a judge or one of the other offices, is he?
Each of them would. Yes. They were all holders of a lucrative office.
But none of them has suggested he wanted to run for the legislature except the one.
Except the one who said he might run for the legislature, he might run for one or two other offices mentioned. The district court also did not mention Article 3, Section 18, which provides that no senator or representative shall, during the term for which he was elected, be eligible to one, any civil office or profit under this state, which shall have been created or the emoluments of which may have been increased during such term, or two, any office or place, the appointment to which may be made in whole or in part by either branch of the legislature. This is the equalizer between the application of Article 3, Section 19, which says that if you're holding a lucrative office in another branch, you cannot run for the legislature during that term. And Article 3, Section 18 states that if you're in the legislature, you cannot run during your term for an office that you created or increased the emoluments of, or that the legislature may act upon the appointment. Creating that provision prevents abuse by legislators.
General Ellison, you say this is an equalizer, but a moment ago you said that the classifications here are not classifications of persons, but rather classification of offices. Do I understand that argument to mean that you don't understand there to be a constitutional duty to treat all offices alike? And if so, you don't even need the equalizer if that argument is right. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm working on two levels. If you adopt the rational basis argument, then any rational basis that can be found to sustain these provisions is sufficient to uphold them. But if you go further, and if you adopt either the means to the end test or some type of balancing test, then these other provisions come into play.
If I understood your argument about difference between offices, not persons, you don't even need a rational basis, because the persons just happen to occupy different offices, and there's no constitutional requirement that different state offices have the same emoluments. There's no constitutional requirement that the county judge be paid the same as a circuit judge, for example. Is that what you were arguing?
Not exactly.
Well, what is the constitutional requirement that different offices be have the same emoluments?
I don't
burdens think, or benefits.
I don't think there is it.
Well, then you don't even need a rational basis.
Well, I think you need a rational basis when you differentiate or distinguish between the qualifications to be a candidate for an office.
Why? Why couldn't you say you need a college education to be a circuit judge, you need a high school education to be a county judge? What's wrong with that?
You can.
Even if it's not rational, even if the one has the more the greater responsibility than the other, what's the constitutional objection?
That is a rational basis.
No, but I would say it's, even if the more difficult job you merely required a high school education for, I don't know why the Constitution would prevent the Texas legislature from doing that.
I don't think it would.
Well, I took it that you were attempting to respond to the rationale of the Fifth Circuit on this. Was that the point you were trying to make?
Yes, it was. There's no question that these provisions of the Texas Constitution create some restrictions on candidate access to the ballot. This court in Bullock versus Carter set the standard in stating that in approaching candidate restrictions, it is essential to examine in a realistic light the extent and nature of their impact on the voters. As I've stated, these provisions serve legitimate state interests. That's not been contested either at the district court or at the Fifth Circuit level. They serve them in the least restrictive means possible. The classifications that are created are reasonably related to the ends to be achieved. So regardless of the standard adopted, be it rational basis, means to an end, the ends means test, or even strict scrutiny, these provisions meet the standards. This court also, in U.S. Civil Service Commission versus National Association of Letter Carriers, quoted Thomas Jefferson, stating as follows, "The right of an officer, the right of any officer, to give his vote at elections as a qualified citizen is not meant to be restrained, nor, however given, shall it have any effect to his prejudice. But it is expected that he will not attempt to influence the votes of others, nor take any part in the business of electioneering, that being deemed inconsistent with the spirit of the Constitution and his duties to it. The people of the state of Texas have elected to require their officers to adhere to this principle. Such is their right under the Constitution."
Mr. Allison, if one subject to the resign or run or runner to the resign rule, those are 4-year term people?
Yes.
Now, if you want to run for an office for the term beginning when yours expires, you're going to have to start running while you're in office.
In the last year, yes, sir.
And so you have to resign under that?
No, sir.
You don't?
In the last year of your 4-year term, you can run
for a term that starts at the expiration of your own.
Yes, sir.
Whether or not you're for re-election of the present office or the new one?
Yes, sir. Without restriction.
Advanced a number of arguments justifying the various classifications in Section 65. But in the answers to your interrogatories at the trial level, or the interrogatories that were propounded, it sounded like at best Section 65 was just the product of maybe some sloppy legislative drafting and that these arguments are rather an afterthought. Is that the case?
It's difficult, if not impossible, to say. There's no legislative history in Texas to support what the rationale may have been for the provisions. The defendants in this case are the executive officers charged with enforcing them. They had no role in the adoption of the provisions. To ask them what was the rationale or basis in the minds of the legislature at the time they adopted the provision is almost impossible to answer. I advanced several arguments that could have been. And that certainly can be sustained as a rational basis for these provisions.
Mr. Campagnaro?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Texas, in Article 16, Section 40, has a prohibition against dual office holding. That means that you cannot hold more than one lucrative office at the same time. Article 16, Section 65 is not a dual office holding prohibition. Article 3, Section 19 started out as a dual office holding provision. And in 1836, they added that clause during the term for which he is elected or appointed. That's what causes the problem in 319 that I'll be discussing later on. In terms of the legislative history here, Section 65 of Article 16 was passed in 1954 after the resolution of the legislature placed it on the ballot for the revision of the Constitution at the general election. And its purpose, and if you look at the head note, says it's a transitional article to provide for the staggering of elections between the various office holders who had been granted four-year terms. In 1958, the paragraph in question here in Section 65 was also made part of the Constitution. And at exactly the same time, verbatim, the same clause came into Article 11, Section 11, that I'll be discussing here in just a second. There is no reason that I know, nor did the state advance any in the courts below, other than that it, the state in the court below simply said that it was going to prevent abuse of office, and therefore that's why the article was placed in there. Now, question was raised here this morning that the district court made an error of fact or of law in neglecting to mention Article 11, Section 11. That was the provision enacted in 1958 which allowed cities in the state of Texas to give four-year terms to members, mayors and members of the city council. They had to vote it in. They didn't give it automatically. Very few cities took advantage of that provision to give members of its city council four-year terms. Perhaps council here in rebuttal can mention one. I don't know of any, but there may be some. Certainly El Paso, Texas, where this case arose, did not take advantage of it. And where Judge Hudspeth sat at the time, members of the city council and municipal courts only had terms of 2 years.
Well, a point, I suppose, isn't the point that if the municipal judges had only 2 year terms and the justice of the peace 4 year, that it's 4 years, it's a...
I apologize. The municipal court judges had 4 year terms, but under our provision, we do not have the application in El Paso nor in most areas of the state of Texas of the 4 year section, Article 11, Section 11 statute. The members of the city council run for 2 years, but the municipal court judges have 4 year terms, but the statute does not apply to offices in, I'm sorry, they have 2 year terms. That statute does not apply in El Paso. My confusion is this. The problem here is that municipal court judges run, and municipal elections in Texas are in odd years. State and county elections are in even years. That means that a municipal court judge, when he comes around, he wants to run in a state election in an even year, does not have to resign the office, even though he's only holding a two-year term.
Well, yes, but then he has less than a year to go.
He has less than a year to go. There's no prohibition.
Yeah.
At all to municipal court judge running. Now, the times here, as far as the Texas election process are concerned, are important. The filing date in Texas since 1959 has been the first Monday in February of an even year. The way you're elected is your term runs until January 31st of an even year. That means, for example, if my term as a judge or another office holder, I would be in office now. If I wanted to run for another office, I would have to file by February 1. However, if I went out and solicited any kind of support for that other office prior to January 1 of this year, the statute does not say private announcement or public announcement. It simply says by the mere solicitation of a campaign contribution or the announcement of any kind, I'm going to be a candidate for some other office. That automatically causes you to vacate your office. An office holder, and therefore you lose that office immediately, and you lose your livelihood for a period of a year, even if you win the office that you are now seeking. And that is even if you're running in the last year of your term. It's even worse if you're running midterm. That is, if you have a 4-year term and you're running 2 years into your term, because then you lose 3 years of your term.
Counsel, are you arguing that the burden is so severe that it's unconstitutional, even if it applied to everybody?
Yes, that is one thing that I'm arguing. That this statute, I argued in the court below, this statute has problems. Both statutes have problems. Even if you apply, well, Section 65 has problems, even if you applied it to everyone.
Well, presumably when they ran for the original office, they took it subject to the burdens that the statute imposed.
That's
so
correct.
So long as there's no equal protection problem, what else would there be?
Because it imposes a burden on voters and on candidates that is unnecessary. What goal is it, Your Honor, that you're trying to further by placing that burden? When you place a burden on election rights, our contention is there should be some reason for it. The state has been able to advance, according to the district court, no valid reason for placing such burdens on candidates.
Well, what happens with states that say you can only serve one term?
There are states that provide that for certain offices you can only hold office for one term.
That's right. Well, what's wrong with that?
I don't know of any prohibition against providing for one term.
Well, isn't that a little more stringent than this one?
Yes, Your Honor, it is more stringent.
Well, under this one, you can serve 26 terms, providing you abide by the law.
The problem with this provision
is... And the other one, you can't serve but one anyway.
That's
now,
correct.
When you talk about restrictions, I think you better get another word, don't you?
Well, the problem is when you're running for that one term, Your Honor, you run for the one term knowing that you're going to keep the one term.
Well, you you run knowing that you can't campaign for the other one.
You run knowing probably that you cannot campaign for any other office.
That's right.
All right.
Well, why is one so bad and the other one's not?
I think that in this case, Your Honor, the policy generally should be that I think you mentioned in one of your opinions there are competing policies here. It used to be that one, you wanted to shorten the ballot, and the other policy was that you wanted to provide people access to the ballot and ways to express their viewpoints. In this case, the problem is you would like to keep people in office and have them tend to their office and not be running for other offices. That's one policy. The competing policy is there are various judges on this very court who have come from other courts. The policy has been that you want people to move up the political ladder, to move up to higher office. This defeats
that
policy.
Where does that policy derive?
It's not written anywhere, Your Honor. The policy generally...
Plus, I don't think any of us ran for this office.
No, you... Well...
We didn't.
No, Your Honor, that's true. But in Texas, judges are political, not appointive. You have to run for office in Texas. That is a decision made by the legislature, obviously making judges political persons, as opposed to some states.
Would it be unconstitutional for Congress to say that no federal judge may run for the United States Senate without first resigning?
Without first resigning?
Without first resigning his judicial office.
My offhand impression would be that it would not, Your Honor. Now, there is... It used to be the law in the state of Texas, and in the Morial case, there is a prohibition of judicial officers running for non-judicial office. That is not the case here. The prohibition in Texas was removed some time ago. I can see a state validly, as in the Morial case, with which we have no quarrel, can say a judicial officer may not run for non-judicial office without resigning the judicial office first. That was upheld in Morial. In this case, we would not have a First Amendment claim. We would have strictly an equal protection claim were that the case.
May I ask you a question about your equal protection claim? What is the most glaring example of unfair treatment? There's so many offices involved, it's hard to know the different dates of running and all. But just pick the two that you think are the worst.
I'll give you a couple. There is actually a case, and you can take the site here. It's 377 Southwest 2nd, and it's also reported in 380 Southwest 2nd. I think it was cited in the earlier briefs, not before this court, by the state. That's the case of Willis versus Potts, Willis versus Fort Worth. It involves really both provisions that are akin to the ones we have in question here in this case.
Well, I'd be much happy if you told me about one in this particular record, the two offices in this record that you think are most arbitrary, there's the most arbitrary discrimination between the two.
All right. I think, for example, county judge.
County
court or county court of law judge. who desires to run for the Court of Civil Appeals, which is the next Court of Appeals up above that court, contrasted with a district court judge, also a trial judge sitting alone, who also reports to the same appellate court. The district judge is not governed by Section 65, may run at midway through a four-year term, keep office even if lost.
Do they have
he is governed by Section 19.
Yes, he may not run for the legislature, guys, because it's a lucrative office. That's correct. He's ineligible for that section. The county court at law judge, let's say they both seek the same office.
Would it not be rational for a legislature to think that they should protect the public from confusing these various courts and judges so that the judge on this county court you speak of would be precluded from having his picture and his posters out around the area saying, keep Judge Moriel on the bench. The public might think they should keep him on when, in fact, he's running for a different office. Now, isn't that a factor a legislature is entitled to take into account?
That's sort of that is a factor, but that's the judicial officer running for a non-judicial position, I think, is what you're raising, which is not really the question.
No, I'm talking about a county judge running for the next highest court.
You can say that, but why would you then turn around and say that a district judge can do that, which a county court of law judge does not? There has to be some reason for the distinction. The state was unable to come up with any reasons at all, even in their brief, coincidentally, say, we've already discussed that distinction. They didn't.
Do the courts have the same kind of jurisdiction?
Akin, the county courts at law, being creatures of the legislature, are given all kinds of different jurisdictions. Some of them have family divorce.
In other words, they have broader jurisdiction than the district judges?
And for example, in probate, they have plenary jurisdiction.
No. I don't need the examples. Does one have a different jurisdiction?
Yes,
than
the district court.
Do they get paid different salaries?
Yes, they do. The district court
in Texas. What is their claim? What constitutional provision do they rely on to say they're entitled to be treated equally? They're not treated equally. They're different offices, pay different salaries with different jurisdictions.
They're not entitled to be treated equally, but to the extent that they are not treated equally, there has to be some reason for it. The state at all.
Could not the legislature, which now pays one more than the other, change its mind and decide to pay that one less than the other?
Conceivably, they could.
Does it have to have a reason other than just want to save some money?
Under your past cases of the Equal Protection Clause, yes, they do have to have a reason when they treat
people.
But
what past cases deal with any requirement to treat different offices equally? The men or women occupy different offices. Why must the offices be alike?
The offices do not have to be alike, but to the extent that they have made a distinction, there has to be some, even at the lowest level of scrutiny.
Do we have to review the distinction in salary or distinction in jurisdiction? Why is there a federal reason why those different offices have to have similar treatment? I don't understand the basic premise on which the whole case rests. Why can't Texas create the XYZ court, give it precisely the same jurisdiction as some other court, but just pay the judges a different salary if it wants to?
It could.
And then why can't it say, well, those judges can have to resign to run, but other judges don't?
Because there, when
they occupy different offices.
When you're paying one more than the other, perhaps it is subject to attack. Perhaps there is no valid reason why you pay one judge more than the other. I'm just assuming that one perhaps has more jurisdiction than the other. But when you're allowing two men with basically the same qualifications to run for the same appellate office, they're both qualified to run for the Court of Appeals, for example. On the one hand, you say, Judge, you're a judge of the county court of law, therefore you lose your office. You're a judge of the district court, you get to keep your office. This court has said even at the lowest level of scrutiny, there has to be some reason for the distinction. The state cannot come up with any.
Well, when you talk about distinctions, supposing that a county court judge is paid $15,000, a district court judge paid $20,000. And then the legislature decides to raise the salary of the district judge to $25,000, but not raise the salary of the county court judge at all. So that whereas the county court judge used to make 75% of what the district judge made, now he makes 60%. Do you think that's subject to attack under the federal constitution?
It may be subject to attack if there was no reason. If the state, I can see the state easily coming up with a reason for that distinction.
Supposing this was something done back in 54 or 56 and the state is in the position, they can't explain at all why the legislature decided to do this. Do you think that then would be subject to attack?
For example, if this court were to examine it and find it no reasonable, in other words, if you're placing burdens on some and not on others, and you're unable to come up with any reason, and you have burdensome rights, then I think the state statute is subject to
attack. Is my example a burden?
I suppose it's a burden of sorts. I suppose someone could conceivably come up with an argument. Here you're talking about something that goes way beyond a mere distinction of salaries. You're talking about a person who's subject to losing office and another person who is not subject to losing office. A tremendous distinction, not one of mere degree, but almost of kind.
Would you urge that we apply a rational basis standard then?
Your Honor, I'm urging that you apply a balancing test, kind of like you did in letter carriers and what the Court of Appeals below suggested in Morion. That is, the closer, that's a good example.
Well, how would you distinguish the letter carriers case where the court upheld the Hatch Act?
Well, there the interest of the government were tremendous. There's a policy of longstanding that in civil service in the United States, you want to keep them as free as possible from political pressures.
Well, here's a policy of longstanding in Section 19 of the state constitution.
Your Honor, that's what I was saying. I don't know of any policy other than that it's a legislative enactment. I'm talking about a reason for it. For example, in letter carriers, there's a reason. We don't want civil servants to become involved in the political process to the extent where they themselves become partisans. The reason behind Section 19, the state of Texas has been able to come up with one. They said it prevents conflicts of interest. And then you pose the hypothetical, what happens if I resign my office? Therefore, there would be no possible conflict of interest. I'm still rendered ineligible. In that situation, they have come up with no distinction whatsoever, no reason for it. The policy decision that I was speaking of earlier is not one that's contained so much in legislation or is embodied in legislation, but simply something the government has come up with, and that's the reason that you have civil service on the federal side.
Counsel, supposing the Postmaster General put into effect a policy against political activity, such as in letter carriers, and the Secretary of HEW did not, could the postal workers claim a denial of equal protection?
Yes, they could, I would think.
Department of Government imposes some such restriction like this, it's invalid unless it's put into effect throughout the government.
This Court has said in the past that the argument was raised by defendants in those cases. You know, you can't expect the legislature to enact everything all at once so everything is uniform. And this Court has held that if someone brings a complaint that they're being treated unequally, you cannot guess and say, well, maybe they... This statute that we have here in this case, Your Honor, has been around for 23 years. I don't know how long we have to wait for the legislature to come up with the provisions to make it equal treatment. 1836, I would think, is long enough on Section 19.
You're starting with an assumption that there is a constitutional requirement that there be equal treatment.
There is, Your Honor. There is equal treatment to the extent that there is not, that there should be some reason for it. That's the test of this Court.
I think you're a little too broad on different agencies. I know some agencies in this government, you can write and print whatever you want them, and I know others you can't.
That's true. And in the application,
I think this Court has passed on that point.
In the Willis case that I was going to mention earlier, two cases, I think they really illustrate the problems of both cases. Willis was a congressman from Fort Worth. Willis decided that he was going to run for the state Senate. Willis announced for election, tried to file his application with a Democratic chairman there in Tarrant County, and the chairman said no. Section 19 makes you ineligible to run for the Texas Senate because your term, even if you resign today, would be extending into the legislative term sought. It was mentioned, but it was not based on the Constitution. They simply went and upheld.
It wasn't based on.
The court did not say, the court found nothing wrong with the provisions under the Texas or the U.S. Constitution, Your Honor. I don't think you are bound by Willis' decision. But I'm mentioning it simply because of the facts that it raises. Now, in Willis, after this person was held to be ineligible to run for the Texas Senate, as soon as he announced for the Texas Senate, though he, by law, could not become a candidate, it was held by the Fort Worth City Council that he had resigned his office because they had it was not 65, but it was something akin to 65. It says as soon as you announce for another office, you lose your spot on the city council. So Willis then filed a second lawsuit and said, since I can't be a candidate for the Texas Senate, I was never a candidate, I should not be losing my office. And they held there, they applied what in effect was Section 65 in the Fort Worth City Charter, and held that he had lost his office also. And that's the kind of situation you get here. You're not eligible to be a candidate. For example, Judge Baca in this case, who wants to run for the legislature, cannot file for the legislature. First of all, he's ineligible. Secondly, as soon as he files or announces for office, he loses the 1 year remaining in his term.
But you're suggesting that the legislature and the people of Texas have the right to say that if we have a person in this particular office, we want him to spend all his time, devote all his energies to that office, and not to dissipate his time and energies by running for another office while he's holding the first one to which he was elected.
The people of the state of Texas, Your Honor, I suppose could say that. But what has happened is that they've said some office holders we're going to apply the rule to and some we're not. For example, if a district attorney decides to run for governor, loses his office. The attorney general decides to run for governor, he does not lose his office. In the state's brief in this case, they say that it shouldn't be applied to state office holders because they're unlikely to run for higher office, when in fact this present attorney general has already filed, he has announced for office. The previous attorney general, John Hill, filed and ran for office and lost. Neither one of them lost their terms. Texas has 256 counties. To allow you only 37 days to test the waters to see whether or not you want to run for office is so restrictive a burden as to be unrealistic. What has happened also is that these provisions were enacted in 1958. At that time, the filing deadline in Texas was in June, which gave you about 5 months to test the waters. Immediately after these provisions were enacted, and I don't know how much thought was given to it, there's no legislative history, in 1959, the legislature moved up the filing deadline to the first Monday in February of each year. So you lost about 4 months of this testing of the waters period. Before, it may have been reasonable with a June deadline. Now, with 37 days saying you cannot run for statewide office or for any other office, if you merely seek office, you have lost your present office. That has such a chilling effect that it has prevented a lot of people, including my clients in this case, they claim in affidavits and in pleadings, that they will not run for those offices so long as we're looking at these legislative provisions. There are no further questions.
Well, there is. Of course, there's another option that's always open, I guess. They could resign their offices and get practice law privately or whatever their skills might be and go in the private sector and then run. They're not totally disabled.
They're not totally disabled, but if you take judges, that is an unrealistic alternative.
Well, I know a lot of judges who've resigned.
There are some who have resigned, but what I'm saying is that there are many others trying to crank up a law practice when you think you might win and have to go back into judicial office.
It's really ironic because my experience has been that most judges think lawyers are better paid than they are. They don't think it's a great sacrifice to go out and have a chance to practice privately.
But under Section 19, the judge could not resign and run.
Under Section 19, it makes no difference if you resign. You're ineligible regardless,
right,
so long as your term extends into the next legislative season.
Well, on that score, the people of Texas, having adopted that, have expressed a view that if we elect you to an office, we expect you to stay there until the end of your term, and this is one inducement, if not a pressure, to keep you there, that you can't run for any other office.
I can see them saying that. And I think it's a fine policy.
Well, they've said that in the Constitution, haven't they?
If it's such a compelling policy, why haven't they said that for the other office holders? It leads you to believe maybe that it's not such a valid reason.
Well, I suppose a lot of people in Texas would say that's none of anybody's business except the people in Texas.
There are. That's true. That has been advanced. But under the decisions of this court, when you do make a distinction between office holders, you have to give you at least, even under the minimum level of scrutiny, some reason for it, some valid reason for it, and the state of Texas cannot. In the 14th Amendment area, if you look at the interrogatories or if you look at the brief here, they have not mentioned any reason for the legislative distinction in Section 65 other than the one you mentioned, Justice, and that was legislative oversight. That, I contend, is not a valid reason. They simply said it was not before the people in 1958. They're agreeing that they never even considered it, Your Honor. Not that they had some reasons. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Allison?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the first place, appellees continue to state that the Article 16, Section 65 provision prohibits testing of the water, and I continue to state that it does not. They have cited a provision of the election code that defines candidacy, but if you read that entire section, it concerns the financial requirements of candidates and states at the beginning of the section that the definitions therein apply only to that chapter. If you look at the state cases construing Article 16, Section 65, you will not find a single case in which a person has been required to resign from an office in which they have made anything other than a clear and definite pronouncement of a candidacy for another office. There's no situation in which a person has been required to resign for merely testing the waters. That is not the situation in Texas. In fact, the election code was recently amended to provide that if you try to file for another office before January 1 and might thereby inadvertently violate Article 16, Section 65, that your filing will be declined and it'll be refused, and that you can only file after January 1, between January 1 and the first Saturday in February, and thereby preventing any inadvertent violation of Article 16, Section 65. Finally, also on the question of the burden, this case was decided on a summary judgment, and the burden, if you use a rational basis test, was upon the plaintiffs to show that there was no rational basis for these provisions. And we have set forth in our brief several. Number one, Article 16, Section 65 applies to your basic entry-level stepping stone political positions, the precinct and county-level positions. Thereby providing a possible basis would be that the people of the state of Texas thought that it's more likely that someone entering at that level would try to run in midterm, trying to step up while trying to hold on to the office that he had. They're entitled to make that distinction. Second, on statewide officials, such as the Attorney General running for governor, they do not serve staggered terms. They're all up at the same time. Their terms expire at the same time. So they would only be running for another state office in the last year of their term, as provided in Article 16, Section 65 anyway. We believe that the plaintiffs have not met their burden in this situation, and that these provisions do not contravene the Constitution of the United States.
Article 3, Section 19 would not prevent you from running in the last year of your office for the legislature if your legislative term would begin when at the expiration of your own term.
It would.
It
would not prevent you running the last year.
Yes.
You could run in the last year for the legislature.
Well, you could begin running whenever you wanted to as far as Article 3, Section 19 is concerned.
That's true.
As long as the term for which you're running begins at the expiration of your own.
Right. That's true. And the terms all expired at the last.
That's not so under 65.
No, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in McAllen.